Before we get started, we're going to be asking you a question at the top of each show for the next few weeks. We want to know more about you, what you like about the show, and what else we could be doing to help you take on the week. Our question this week is, aside from WSJ's Take on the Week, what's your go-to source for financial news? Other news outlets, social media, friends and family? If you're listening on Spotify, look for our poll under the episode description, or you can send us an email at takeontheweek@wsj.com. Now, on to the show. What's good, everybody? I'm Dion Raboan for The Wall Street Journal, and this is WSJ's Take on the Week, the show where we break down the most important things to watch in business and financial news. We cut through the noise to get you ready for what matters. Three of the biggest U.S. banks are set to deliver their earnings reports this week, marking the unofficial start of the first quarter's earnings season. We are looking forward to reports from Citigroup, Wells Fargo, and the largest bank in the country, J.P. Morgan Chase. Josh Brown and Michael Batnick are here from Ritholtz Wealth Management to give you the goods on everything you need to know ahead of this week's reports. If you weren't watching, you may have missed the rally in oil and gas prices this year. And there could even be higher prices on the horizon thanks to a report on deck from the International Energy Agency. We'll tell you what it is and why it could move markets this week. And finally, we'll be talking about CPI. The latest reading on U.S. inflation is set for Wednesday, and in the immortal words of De La Soul, the stakes is high. We'll explain why this week's data could change the conversation about inflation. But first, let's talk about finance. That's why you're here, right? The big banks always provide valuable information on the finances of consumers and businesses, how much we're spending, how much we're saving, and whether we've been taking risks. That last one is especially important right now. For the economy to grow, business owners and everyday Americans have to be confident enough to take risks. Risk taking on a new job, starting a new company, or borrowing money to buy some new things. Given the strong performance of risky assets like leveraged loans, tech stocks, and cryptocurrencies so far this year, it certainly feels like risk is in the air. But this week, we'll find out what the numbers say. Josh Brown is the CEO, and Michael Batnick is a managing partner of Ritholtz Wealth Management, which manages around $4 billion worth of assets. Together, they host the very popular podcast, The Compound and Friends. And they join me now to talk about this week's big financial earnings reports. We are about a year removed from the failure of First Republic and three of the four biggest bank failures in U.S. history. But the financial sector is one of the best performers in the S&P 500 this year. Michael, I want to start with you. Why have financial stocks done so well this year?
It's such a good question. I think one of the reasons why is because we were coming off of a very low base. To your point, 2023 was a very challenging year for a lot of banks. There was the cash sorting issues, which is a fancy term for people basically getting out of their yieldless checking accounts or savings accounts and moving into something that was offering the full 500 basis points that the overnight rate was offering. There was, as you mentioned, the Silicon Valley Bank crisis was obviously a big one. 2023 was a rough year for banks, and now we're on the other side of that, where a lot of the bankruptcies that were forecasted to happen did not happen. Delinquencies that we were expecting are not coming to fruition. So things are okay. I think people put their head between their knees and were bracing for impact, and we never got the impact.
And Josh, I heard you bought some New York Community Bank stock. Now, a big reason that stock has fallen so much this year is because of that bank's exposure to commercial real estate, office buildings, things like that. So are you taking the bet that this danger has passed?
No, I was in that stock for 2 days.
Okay.
I just thought it was overdone. I was wrong, but it wasn't like a material impact. It was already a $3 stock. I do think, broadly speaking, to echo what Michael was saying, it's a great economy. So what should the bank stocks be doing? They're making a ton of money. They have high interest rates. Well, I mean, relatively high. For the first time in 15 years, there's like a spread. And so they should be making lots of money, and they are. This isn't the best environment in the world for banks, but it's pretty good.
And the Fed's Bank Term Funding Program, I think, is certainly part of this. When we had those bank runs last March, the Fed swooped in with this program that has now provided banks with more than $163 billion of funding. But Michael, I want to get your take. How important was that to the gains in financial stocks over this past year?
Financial stocks are doing incredibly well. 98.6% of XLF members are above their 200-day moving average. Effectively, what that means is all banks are in an uptrend. And 98.6 is as close to 100 as you really get. So it doesn't really
get much. And that XLF, that's that bank ETF, right? The folks
can buy. So the biggest hold, it's cap-weighted. It's Berkshire Hathaway. It's JP Morgan. It's the gigantic banks. And American Express.
Insurance companies, credit cards.
Yeah, American Express. Financial stocks. So I don't know how important that was to the actual gains, but it was vital to the functioning of these regional banks. If they didn't step in that weekend and did what they had to do, the bank run would have got a lot worse. So I thought that they did a great job stepping in. It was necessary. Even with doing what they did, you saw a lot of regional banks go under, and it would have been a lot worse.
What's really interesting is that we've basically, without any vote in Congress, we have effectively ended the upside limit to FDIC protection. And before anybody listening to this starts screaming about the taxpayer, the cost of this is going to be borne basically by JP Morgan and Bank of America. The industry has to fund the FDIC. And so they'll pay increased fees, but as a result, they won't have the chaos of a run on regional banks. So the system will operate smoothly. And I don't think anyone's going to worry anymore about something like a bank going under, because we know what the government will do now. Hmm. They'll throw out management. They'll take over. They'll resolve the bank. They'll hand it off to a stronger player. The accounts will remain untouched. And that's a really interesting development that just like basically happened. It happened on a Sunday. And now that's just the law of the land that we've all gotten accustomed to. I don't even think we're talking about it anymore.
But I just want to get back to all of the stocks that we're talking about at or near record highs. It's not for no reason. It's not because the government stepped in. It's because they are reflecting the fundamental reality. American Express, in their fourth quarter earnings, said that we delivered record profits and revenues. They serve customers, you know, affluent ones, but it's the same thing if you listen to Bank of America, who serves everyone, or Visa, or MasterCard. Like, they're all saying the same thing, that the consumer remains resilient. You see the boom in travel spending is not slowing down. And here's an interesting wrinkle. It's not just the rich people. It's not just the boomers. So in American Express's report, they said that the year-over-year growth in cards from baby boomers was 2%, and spending was 31% of the total. Millennials and Gen Z grew 15% year-over-year, and we're 32% of the total. So it's not only a rich person thing or the older people. Millennials and Gen Z are coming up the rear and they're doing very well. So the consumer's doing well. There's no reason to think that the banks that serve them wouldn't also be doing well.
So we get Citi, JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, all reporting earnings this week. I want to ask this in two ways. Michael, what's the biggest question about the economy and U.S. consumers that you think could be answered by this week's earnings?
I'm curious to see the sort of reserves that they're putting aside. We spoke a lot about like people getting ready for the recession that never came. The banks were prepared. They had a lot of losses coming down the pike that really never materialized. So I'm curious to hear how the consumer is doing on a go-forward basis, because they're spending more than ever. And a lot of this is people talking about credit buildup. But if you look at credit as a percentage of disposable income, or if you adjust the denominator, it's not that the consumer is over-levered or anything like that. This is much different than the last time that banks were leading. So I guess I'm just curious to hear what they're going to say on a go-forward basis.
Mm. And then the other question I want to ask is, Josh, for investors, what's the most important thing you're hoping to hear from those big banks this week?
Well, to Michael's point, I'd be curious to hear, since those losses have not yet materialized and these companies were quote-unquote battening down the hatches circa early 2022, are there reserves that should now find their way into the income statement? Should we be dropping some of those reserves and turning that back into profit? And if so, there's your upside surprise, especially for the money center banks, more so than, you know, let's say Goldman and Morgan. Another subplot that's interesting, which we haven't talked about yet, are the asset managers. understand that 2022 was hell on earth. These are companies that manage both stocks and bonds. Bonds fell 16% and stocks fell 20%. That does not happen. That's maybe happened three times in 100 years. To have double-digit declines in the two main asset classes all happen in the same calendar year, it could not be worse if you run ETFs or mutual funds or manage any kind of pool of liquid investable assets. So we've just lived through that. And now we're coming out of that, and it'll be really interesting to see if BlackRock and State Street, stock price-wise, can get their acts together.
BlackRock and State Street are scheduled to report their earnings on Friday, along with Citi, JP Morgan, and Wells Fargo. I know Josh and Michael will be watching, and so will we. When we come back, we're going to talk about a major report on the oil market that could have an impact on your wallet this month, this year, and into 2025.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
So last week, the Journal published an article with the headline, Why Gasoline Prices Are Rising Faster Than Usual. If you weren't thinking about gas prices in the first quarter, because you were busy watching Bitcoin rise 67%, or cocoa prices rise 133%, or the S&P 500 hit 22 new record highs, that would be understandable. But it's time to pay attention. This week's report on oil supply and demand from the International Energy Agency will play a role in whether the double-digit increase we saw in oil prices in Q1 and the 30% increase we saw in gasoline prices will continue. WSJ markets reporter David Uberti wrote the story on why gasoline prices are rising faster than usual, and he joins me now to talk about what that means and why the report that's expected on Friday from the IEA could move oil prices, stock prices, and more. So we are expecting that IEA global supply and demand report this week. How could this report move oil markets and also maybe move stocks this week?
Well, there's a few things to understand here with these oil market reports. The oil market is an intensely political being. On the one hand, you have oil producers, as well as OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. On the other hand, you have a lot of big consuming countries, including Europe and the United States, which back an organization called the International Energy Agency, which is the report that you referenced. Mm-hmm. You know, for decades, those two organizations have sort of been mirror images of each other in terms of the interests they represent. The producers on the one hand and the major consumers on the other hand. And increasingly, and perhaps implicitly, those two camps have divergent views of where oil demand will go in the next 5 to 10 to 15 years. And this makes a big difference for what you might consider peak oil to be. So what's happening this week is the IEA, which is the group that represents consuming countries, they're putting out their first projection of what they think global oil consumption will be in 2025. So this is what informs how companies might invest in new production in the market. This informs how traders might bet on prices rising or falling throughout 2025, what the actual balance of oil in the market might be. And then ultimately, this will inform what energy stocks do, because they are dictated by the price of oil, as well as what you and me actually pay at the gasoline pump. If they project higher demand in 2025, we could generally expect that prices will be higher for us and everyone else around the world. If they project lower demand, the opposite will likely be true.
All that said, what's the biggest question you've got going into this report?
The biggest question is whether the IEA will revise upward their demand forecast. They are projecting that peak oil demand globally, when the world's hunger for oil will peak, will come sooner rather than later compared to many other forecasters. And over the last several of these reports, the IEA, which has taken a very aggressive view in terms of demand peaking sooner rather than later, has actually revised its demand forecasts upward. in the future. So they have been surprised consistently by how big of an appetite the world has for oil.
Why has IEA consistently been under-expecting the demand for oil? Is that purely political, or is there something that they just have been surprised by in terms of the data?
First and foremost, the global economy over the last year to 18 months has been much stronger than a lot of economists forecasted, if you were asking them in 2022 or even in the depths of the pandemic. So generally speaking, economic growth always equates to growing oil demand. I mean, it's important for me to also say that while the IEA has revised upward its estimates in some respects, on the other end of the spectrum, OPEC has very high estimates over the course of time.
You've written that gasoline prices are rising faster than usual this year and faster than they have typically over like the past 25 years. Obviously, oil and gas are pretty connected, but what's been the story in oil so far this year?
Well, the big unexpected thing that happened to the market was that U.S. oil production boomed to become greater than any country has ever produced before. And it really shocked people around the world who invest in this stuff and trade in this stuff. And ultimately, it kept prices down far lower than many projections expected. This year, most people expect that the U.S. growth is going to taper off for a couple of different reasons. In addition to that, OPEC, this collection of different big producing countries, they instituted these cuts last year that I previously mentioned, and those cuts are finally starting to have an impact. Saudi Arabia and Russia in particular, as well as some other members, have taken an incredible amount of oil off the market they could be producing at this point. And so that's having the effect of tightening the market right now. But it's all about supply and demand. And if the IEA revises what their projections are upward for, say, supply, that'll mean the market is looser. That'll mean prices would theoretically go down, barring something unforeseen. On the other hand, if they say demand might be higher than expected throughout the rest of 2024 or even 2025, either due to economic growth or perhaps due to energy transition hurdles, that could force prices to go up as well.
That was WSJ reporter David Uberti. Up next, we'll break down the high stakes of this week's CPI inflation report.
WSJ Special Access gives you a front row seat to some of the Wall Street Journal's most exciting content, like The Quirkier Side of Life, a new series that features the fun, surprising stories our reporters come across.
The chief executive walks 10,000 barefoot steps every day. He recalls stepping on a bee, which put him off earthing for a couple of days, but he got back to it.
Check out The Quirkier Side of Life on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
Okay, one more thing before we get out of here. Let's talk about CPI. This week's inflation data is big, like big, because it will tell us whether inflation is continuing to move towards the Federal Reserve's 2% target, meaning that the Fed can set the table to lower U.S. interest rates this summer, as investors are expecting, or whether inflation is stuck around 3%, or even worse, that inflation is starting to rise again. The last 3 months, the CPI report has shown inflation above expectations. Fed Chair Jerome Powell has said the central bank's target is still very much 2%. But he's also said that seasonal adjustments and other issues with how the data are measured could be to blame for the hotter-than-expected inflation prints we've seen. And that's fine for the first 2 or 3 months of the year. It happens. But 4 months? Nah. 4 months, my friend, a trend doth make. So you can expect markets to react if this week's CPI report comes in above economist expectations. My colleague Anna Hertenstein, who covers markets for the Journal, lays out what's at stake for Wednesday's report.
As central bankers have said, they're still looking for data that would show that this fight against inflation is actually working. And timing here is really crucial. Nobody wants to cut rates too soon and have to raise them again if we have a more prolonged issue. And there actually is a historical precedent here. The last time that inflation was at the levels that we recently had was in the 1970s. And the process then to bring it back down wasn't smooth either. They actually had a second wave where consumer prices re-accelerated after dropping. And nobody wants this history to repeat itself. A few things that we've been watching recently in relation to inflation is that oil prices have been picking up again recently, and the Baltimore Bridge accident closed the port there, which risks more supply chain issues. And these are adding to risks linked to inflation.
Listen, you may be done with inflation, but as Anna points out, inflation may not be done with you just yet. And that's everything you need to know to take on the week for Sunday, April 7th. The show is produced by Jess Jupiter. Jonathan Sanders is our booking producer. Michael Laval and Jessica Fenton are our sound designers. Michael also wrote our theme music. Melanie Roy is our supervising producer. Aisha Al-Muslim is our development producer. Scott Soloway and Chris Zinsley are the deputy editors. And Falana Patterson is the head of news audio for The Wall Street Journal. For even more, head to WSJ.com. I'm Dion Rabone. Stay smart.